This is Audible.
Phoenix Books presents Larry McMurtry's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Lonesome Dove. This unabridged performance by Lee Horsley is copyright 2016 Phoenix Books. It has been digitally remastered from the 1992 Dove audio sound recording. Part 1, Chapter 1.
When Augustus came out on the porch, the blue pigs were eating a rattlesnake. Not a very big one. It had probably just been crawling around looking for shade when it ran into the pigs. They were having a fine tug-of-war with it, and its rattling days were over. The sow had it by the neck, and the shote had the tail. "Hey, you pigs, get," Augustus said, kicking the shote. "Head on down to the creek if you want to eat that snake." It was the porch he begrudged them, not the snake. Pigs on the porch just made things hotter, and things were already hot enough. He stepped down into the dusty yard and walked around to the spring house to get his jug. The sun was still high, sold in the sky like a mule, but Augustus had a keen eye for sun, and to his eye the long light from the west had taken on an encouraging slant. Evening took a long time getting to Lonesome Dove, but when it came it was a comfort. For most of the hours of the day, and most of the months of the year, the sun had the town trapped deep in dust, far out in the chaparral flats, a haven for snakes and horned toads and roadrunners and stinging lizards, but a hell for pigs and Tennesseans. There was not even a respectable shade tree within 20 or 30 miles. In fact, the actual location of the nearest decent shade was a matter of vigorous debate in the offices. If you wanted to call a roofless barn and a couple of patched-up corrals offices of the Hat Creek Cattle Company, half of which Augustus owned. His stubborn partner, Captain W.F. Call, maintained that there was excellent shade as close as Pickles Gap, only 12 miles away, but Augustus wouldn't allow it. Pickles Gap was, if anything, a more worthless community than Lonesome Dove. It had only sprung up because a fool from North Georgia named Wesley Pickles had gotten himself and his family lost in the mesquites for about 10 days. When he finally found a clearing, he wouldn't leave it, and Pickles Gap came into being, mainly attracting travelers like its founder, which is to say people too weak-willed to be able to negotiate a few hundred miles of mesquite thicket without losing their nerve. The spring house was a little lumpy adobe building, so cool on the inside that Augustus would have been tempted to live in it had it not been for its popularity with black widows and yellow jackets and centipedes. When he opened the door, he didn't immediately see any centipedes, but he did immediately hear the nervous buzz of a rattlesnake that was evidently smarter than the one the pigs were eating. Augustus could just make out the snake coiled in the corner, but decided not to shoot it. On a quiet spring evening in Lonesome Dove, a shot could cause complications. Everybody in town would hear it and conclude that either the Comanches were down from the plains or the Mexicans up from the river. If any of the customers of the Dry Bean, the town's one saloon, happened to be drunk or unhappy, which was very likely, they would probably run out into the street and shoot a Mexican or two just to be on the safe side. At the very least, Call would come stomping up from the lots, only to be annoyed to discover it had just been a snake. Call had no respect whatsoever for snakes, or for anyone who stood aside for snakes. He treated rattlers like gnats, disposing of them with one stroke of whatever tool he had in his hand. "A man that slows down for snakes might as well walk," he said, a statement that made about as much sense to an educated man as most of the things Call said. Augustus held to a more leisurely philosophy. He believed in giving creatures a little time to think. So he stood in the sun a few minutes until the rattler calmed down and crawled out a hole. Then he reached in and lifted his jug out of the mud. It had been a dry year, even by the standards of Lonesome Dove, and the spring was just springing enough to make a nice mud puddle. The pigs spent half their time rooting around the spring house, hoping to get into the mud, but so far none of the holes in the adobe was big enough to admit a pig. The damp burlap the jug was wrapped in naturally appealed to the centipedes, so Augustus made sure that none had sneaked under the wrapping before he uncorked the jug and took a modest swig. The one white barber in Lonesome Dove, a fellow Tennessean named Dillard Brawley, had to do his barbering on one leg because he had not been cautious enough about centipedes. Two of the vicious red-legged variety had crawled into his pants one night, and Dillard had got up in a hurry and had neglected to shake out his pants. A leg hadn't totally rotted off, but it had rotted sufficiently that the family got nervous about blood poisoning and persuaded he and Carl to saw it off. For a year or two, Lonesome Dove had had a real doctor, but the young man had lacked good sense. A vaquero with a loose manner that everybody was getting ready to hang at the first excuse anyway passed out from drink one night and let a blister bug crawl in his ear. The bug couldn't find its way out, but it could move around enough to upset the vaquero, who persuaded the young doctor to try and flush it. The young man was doing his best with some warm salt water, but the vaquero lost his temper and shot him. It was a fatal mistake on the vaquero's part. Someone blasted his horse out from under him as he was racing away, and the incensed citizenry, most of whom were nearby at the dry bean, passing the time, hung him immediately. Unfortunately, no medical man had taken an interest in the town since, and Augustus and Call, both of whom had coped with their share of wounds, got called on to do such surgery as was deemed essential. Dillard Brawley's leg had presented no problem, except that Dillard screeched so loudly that he injured his vocal cords. He got around good on one leg, but the vocal cords had never fully recovered, which ultimately hurt his business. Dillard had always liked to talk too much, but after the trouble with the centipedes, what he did was whisper too much. Customers didn't relax under their hot towels for trying to make out Dillard's whispers. He hadn't really been worth listening to, even when he had two legs. And in time, many of his customers drifted off to the Mexican barber. Call even used a Mexican, and Call didn't trust Mexicans or barbers. Augustus took the jug back to the porch and placed his rope-bottom chair so as to utilize the smidgen of shade he had to work with. As the sun sank, the shade would gradually extend itself across the porch, the wagon yard, Hat Creek, Lonesome Dove, and eventually the Rio Grande. By the time the shade had reached the river, Augustus would have mellowed with the evening and be ready for some intelligent conversation, which usually involved talking to himself. Call would work until slap dark if he could find anything to do, and if he couldn't find anything, he would make up something. P.I. was too much of a corporal to quit before the captain quit, even if Call would have let him. The two pigs had quietly disregarded Augustus's orders to go to the creek and were under one of the wagons eating the snake. That made good sense, for the creek was just as dry as the wagon yard and further off. 50 weeks out of the year, Hat Creek was nothing but a sandy ditch, and the fact that the two pigs didn't regard it as a fit wallow was a credit to their intelligence. Augustus often praised the pigs' intelligence in a running argument he had been having with Call for the last few years. Augustus maintained that pigs were smarter than all horses and most people, a claim that galled Call severely. "No slop-eating pig is as smart as a horse," Call said, before going on to say worse things. As was his custom, Augustus drank a fair amount of whiskey as he sat and watched the sun ease out of the day. If he wasn't tilting the rope-bottom chair, he was tilting the jug. The days in Lonesome Dove were a blur of heat, as dry as chalk, but mash whiskey took some of the dry away and made Augustus feel nicely misty inside, foggy and cool as a morning in the Tennessee hills. He seldom got downright drunk, but he did enjoy feeling misty along about sundown, keeping his mood good with tasteful swigs as the sky to the west began to color up. The whiskey didn't damage his intellectual powers any, but it did make him more tolerant of the raw sorts he had to live with. Call and P.I. and Dietz, young Newt, and old Bolivar, the cook. When the sky had pinked up nicely over the western flats, Augustus went around to the back of the house and kicked the kitchen door a time or two. "Better warm up the sow belly and mash a few beans." Old Bolivar didn't answer, so Augustus kicked at the door once or twice more to emphasize his point. He went back to the porch. The blue shote was waiting for him at the corner of the house, quiet as a cat. It was probably hoping that he would drop something, a belt, pocket knife, or a hat, so he could eat it. "Get from here, Shote," Augustus said. "If you're that hungry, go hunt up another snake." It occurred to him that the leather belt couldn't be much tougher or less palatable than a fried goat Bolivar served up 3 or 4 times a week. The old man had been a competent Mexican bandit before he ran out of steam and crossed the river. Since then, he had led a quiet life, but it was a fact that goat kept turning up on the table. The Hat Creek Cattle Company didn't trade in them, and it was unlikely that Bolivar was buying them out of his own pocket. Stealing goats was probably his way of keeping up his old skills. His old skills did not include cooking. The goat meat tasted like it had been fried in tar, but Augustus was the only member of the establishment sensitive enough to raise a complaint. "Bull, where did you get the tar you fried this goat in?" he asked regularly, his quiet attempt at wit falling as usual on deaf ears. Bolivar ignored all queries, direct or indirect. Augustus was getting about ready to start talking to the sow and the shoat when he saw Call and P.I. walking up from the lots. P.I. was tall and lank. He had never been full in his life. He looked so awkward that he appeared to be about to fall down even when he was standing still. He looked totally helpless, but that was another case of looks deceiving. In fact, he was one of the ablest men Augustus had ever known. He had never been an outstanding Indian fighter, but if you gave him something that he could work at deliberately, like carpentering or blacksmithing or well digging or harness repair, he was excellent. If he had been a man to do sloppy work, Call would have run him off long before. Augustus walked down and met the men at the wagons. "It's a little early for you two to be quitting, ain't it, girls? Or is this Christmas, or what?" Both men had sweated their shirts through so many times during the day that they were practically black. Augustus offered Call a jug, and Call put a foot on the wagon tongue and took a swig just to rinse the dry out of his mouth. He spat a mouthful of perfectly good whiskey in the dust and handed the jug to P.I. "Girls yourself," he said. "It ain't Christmas." And then he went on to the house so abruptly that Augustus was a little taken aback. Call had never been one for fine manners, but if the day's work had gone to his satisfaction, he would usually stand and pass the time a minute. The funny thing about Woodrow Call was how hard he was to keep in scale. He wasn't a big man. In fact, he was barely middle-sized, but when you walked up and looked him in the eye, it didn't seem that way. Augustus was 4 inches taller than his partner, and P.I. 3 inches taller yet. But there was no way you could have convinced P.I. that Captain Call was the short man. Call had him buffaloed, and in that respect, P. had plenty of company. If a man meant to hold his own with Call, it was necessary to keep in mind that Call wasn't as big as he seemed. Augustus was the one man in South Texas who could usually keep him in scale, and he built on that advantage whenever he could. He started many a day by pitching Call a hot biscuit and remarking point blank, "You know, Call, you ain't really no giant." A simple heart like P could never understand such behavior. It gave Augustus a laugh sometimes to consider that Call could hoodwink a man nearly twice his size, getting P to confuse the inner with the outer man. But, of course, Call himself had such a single-track mind that he scarcely realized he was doing it. He just did it. What made it a fascinating trick was that Call had never noticed that he had a trick. The man never wasted 5 minutes appreciating himself. It would have meant losing 5 minutes of whatever job he had decided he wanted to get done that day. "It's a good thing I ain't scared to be lazy," Augustus told him once. "You may think so. I don't," Call said. "Hell, Call, if I worked as hard as you, there'd be no thinking done around this outfit at all. But you stay in a lather 15 hours a day, and a man that's always in a lather can't think nothing out." "I'd like to see you think the roof back on that barn," Call said. Strange little wind had whipped over from Mexico and blown the roof off clean as a whistle 3 years before. Fortunately, it only rained in Lonesome Dove once or twice a year, so the loss of the roof didn't result in much suffering for the stock when there was stock. It mostly meant suffering for Call, who had never been able to locate enough decent lumber to build a new roof. Unfortunately, a rare downpour had occurred only about a week after the wind dropped the old roof in the middle of Hat Creek. It had been a real turd floater. also a lumber floater, washing much of the roof straight into the Rio Grande. "If you think so much, why didn't you think of that rain?" Call asked. Ever since, he had been throwing the turd floater up to Augustus. Give Call a grievance, however silly, and he would save it like money. P.I. wasn't spitting out any mash whiskey. He had a skinny neck, and his Adam's apple bulged so when he drank that it reminded Augustus of a snake with a frog stuck in his gullet. "Call looks mad enough to kick a stump," Augustus said. When P. finally stopped to breathe, "Well, she bit a hunk out of him, that's why," P. said. "I don't know why a captain wants to keep her." "Fillies are his only form of folly," Augustus said. "What's he doing letting a horse bite him? I thought you boys were digging a new well." "Hit rock," P. said. "Ain't room for but one man to swing a pick down in that hole, so Newt swung it while I shod the horses. Captain took a ride, and I guess he thought he had her sweated down. He turned his back on her, and she bit a hunk out." The mare in question was known around town as Hell Bitch. Call had bought her in Mexico from some caballeros who claimed to have killed an Indian to get her. Comanche, they said. Augustus doubted that part of the story. It was unlikely that one Comanche had been riding around by himself in that part of Mexico. If there had been two Comanches, the caballeros wouldn't have lived to do any horse trading. The mare was a dapple gray, with a white muzzle and a white streak down her forehead. Too tall to be pure Indian pony and too short barrel to be pure thoroughbred. Her disposition did suggest some time spent with the Indians, but which Indians and how long was anybody's guess. Every man who saw her wanted to buy her. She was that stylish, but Call wouldn't even listen to an offer, though P.I. and Newt were both anxious to see her sold. They had to work around her every day and suffered accordingly. She'd once kicked Newt all the way into the blacksmith shop, nearly into the forge. P.I. was at least as scared of her as he was of Comanches, which was saying a lot. "What's keeping Newt?" Augustus asked. "He may have went to sleep down in that well," P.I. said. Then Augustus saw the boy walking up from the lot, so tired he was barely moving. P.I. was half drunk by the time Newt finally made the wagons. "I God, Newt, I'm glad you got here before fall," Augustus said. "We'd have missed you during the summer." "I've been throwing rocks at the mare," Newt said, with a grin. "Did you see what a hunk she bit out of the captain?" Newt lifted one foot and carefully scraped the mud from the well off the sole of his boot, while P.I. continued to wash the dust out of his throat. Augustus had always admired the way Newt could stand on one leg while cleaning the other boot. "Look at that, P. I'll bet you can't do that." P.I. was so used to seeing Newt stand on one leg to clean his boot that he couldn't figure out what it was Gus thought he couldn't do. A few big swigs of liquor sometimes slowed his thinking down to a crawl. This usually happened at sundown after a hard day of well digging or horseshoeing. At such times, P. was doubly glad he worked with the captain rather than Gus. The less talk the captain had to listen to, the better humor he was in, whereas Gus was just the opposite. He'd rattle off five or six different questions and opinions, running them all together like so many unbranded cattle. It made it hard to pick out one and think about it carefully and slowly, the only ways P. liked to think. At such times, his only recourse was to pretend the questions had hit him in his deaf ear, the left one, which hadn't really worked well since the day of their big fight with the Keechies, what they call the Stonehouse fight. It had been pure confusion since the Indians had been smart enough to fire the prairie grass, smoking things up so badly that no one could see 6 feet ahead. They kept bumping into the Indians in the smoke and having to shoot point blank. A ranger right next to P had spotted one and fired too close to P's ear. That was the day that the Indians got away with their horses, which made Captain Call about as mad as P had ever seen him. It meant they had to walk down the Brazos for nearly 200 miles, worrying constantly about what would happen if the Comanches discovered that they were afoot. P, I hadn't noticed he was half deaf until they had walked most of the way out. Fortunately, while he was worrying the question of what it was he couldn't do, old Bolivar began to whack the dinner bell, which put an end to the discussion. The old dinner bell had lost its clapper, but Bolivar had found a crowbar that somebody had managed to break, and he laid into that bell so hard that you couldn't have heard the clapper if there had been one. The sun had finally set, and it was so still along the river that they could hear the horses swishing their tails down in the lots. Or they could until Bolivar laid into the bell. Although he probably knew that they were standing around the wagons in easy hearing distance, Bolivar continued to pound the bell for a good 5 minutes. Bolivar pounded the bell for reasons of his own. Even Carl couldn't control him in that regard. The sound drowned out the quiet of sunset, which annoyed Augustus so much that at times he was tempted to go up and shoot the old man just to teach him a lesson. "I figure he's calling bandits," Augustus said when the ringing finally stopped. They started for the house, and the pigs fell in with him, the shoat eating a lizard he had caught somewhere. The pigs liked Newt even better than Augustus. When he didn't have anything better to do, he'd feed them scraps of rawhide and scratch their ears. "If the bandits were to come, maybe the captain would let me start wearing a gun," Newt said wistfully. It seemed he would never get old enough to wear a gun, though he was 17. "If you was to wear a gun, somebody would mistake you for a gunfighter and shoot you," Augustus said, noting the boy's wistful look. "It ain't worth it. If Bowl ever calls up any bandits, I'll lend you my Henry." "That old man can barely cook," P.I. remarked. "Where would he get any bandits?" "Why, you remember that greasy bunch he had," Augustus said. "We used to buy horses from him. That's the only reason Carl hired him to cook. In the business we're in, it don't hurt to know a few horse thieves, as long as they're Mexicans. I figure Bowles just biding his time. As soon as he gains our trust, his bunch will sneak up some night and murder us all." He didn't believe anything of the kind. He just liked to stimulate the boy once in a while, and Pete too, though Pete was an exceptionally hard man to stimulate, being insensitive to most fears. Pete had just sense enough to fear Comanches. That didn't require an abundance of sense. Mexican bandits did not impress him. Newt had more imagination. He turned and looked across the river where a big darkness was about to settle. Every now and then, about sundown, the captain and Augustus and P and Dietz would strap on guns and ride off into that darkness, into Mexico, and return about sunup with 30 or 40 horses or perhaps 100 skinny cattle. It was the way the stock business seemed to work along the border. The Mexican ranchers raided north while the Texans raided south. Some of the skinny cattle spent their lives being chased back and forth across the Rio Grande. Newt's fondest hope was to get old enough to be taken along on the raids. Many a night he lay in his hot little bunk listening to old Bolivar snore and mumble below him, peering out the window towards Mexico, imagining the wild doings that must be going on. Once in a while he even heard gunfire, though seldom more than a shot or two. It got his imagination to working all the harder.
You can go when you're grown," the captain said.
And that was all he said. There was no arguing with it either, not if you were just hired help. Arguing with the captain was a privilege reserved for Mr. Gus. They no sooner got in the house, and Mr. Gus began to exercise the privilege. The captain had his shirt off, letting Bolivar treat his mare bite. She'd got him just above the belt. Enough blood had run down into his pants that one pants leg was caked with it. Bull was about to pack the bite with his usual dope, a mixture of axle grease and turpentine, but Mr. Gus made him wait until he could get a look at the wound himself.
"By God, Woodrow," Augustus said. "As long as you worked around horses, it looks to me like you'd know better than to turn your back on a Kiowa mare."
Gall was thinking of something and didn't answer for a minute. What he was thinking was that the moon was in the quarter, what they call a rustler's moon. Let it get full over the pale flats, and some Mexicans could see well enough to draw a fair bead. Men he'd ridden with for years were dead and buried, or at least dead because they'd crossed the river under a full moon. No moon at all was nearly as bad. Then it was too hard to find the stock, and too hard to move it. The quarter moon was the right moon for a swing below the border. The brush country to the north was already thick with cattlemen making up their spring herds and getting trail crews together. It wouldn't be a week before they began to drift into Lonesome Dove. It was time to gather cattle. "Who said she was Kiowa?" he said, looking at Augustus.
"I've reasoned it out," Augustus said. "You could have done the same thing if you ever stopped working long enough to think."
"Well, I can work and think, too," Carl said. "You're the only man I know whose brain don't work unless it's in the shade." Augustus ignored the remark.
"I figure it was a Kiowa on his way to steal a woman that lost that mare," he said. "Your Comanche don't hunger much for senoritas. White women are easier to steal and don't eat as much besides. The Kiowa are different. They fancy senoritas."
"Can we eat, or do we have to wait until the argument's over?" P. asked.
"We starve if we wait for that," Bolivar said, plunking a pot full of sow belly and beans down on the rough table.
Augustus, to the surprise of no one, was the first to fill his plate.
"I don't know where you keep finding these Mexican strawberries," he said, referring to the beans. Bolivar managed to find them 365 days a year, mixing them with so many red chilies that a spoonful of beans was more or less as hot as a spoonful of red ants.
Newt had come to think that only two things were certain if you worked for the Hat Creek Cattle Company. One was that Captain Call would think of more things to do than he and P.I. and Dietz could get done. The other was that beans would be available at all meals. The only man in the outfit who didn't fart frequently was old Bolivar himself. He never touched beans and lived mainly on sourdough biscuits and chicory coffee, or rather cups of brown sugar with little puddles of coffee floating on top. The sugar cost money, too, and it irked the captain to spend it. But old Bolivar could not be made to break a habit. Augustus claimed that the old man's droppings were so sugary that the blue shoat had taken to stalking him every time he went to shit, which might have been true. Newt had all he could do to keep clear of the shoat, and his own droppings were mostly bean. By the time Carl got his shirt on and came to the table, Augustus was reaching for a second helping. P and Newt were casting nervous glances at the pot, hoping for seconds themselves, but too polite to grab before everyone had been served. Augustus's appetite was a kind of natural calamity. Carl had watched it with amazement for 30 years, and yet it still surprised him to see how much Augustus ate. He didn't work unless he had to, and yet he could sit down night after night and out-eat three men who had put in a day's labor. In their rangerin' days, when things were a little slow, the boys would sit around and swap stories about Augustus's eating. Not only did he eat a lot, he ate it fast. The cook that wanted to hold him at the grub for more than 10 minutes had better have a side of beef handy. Carl pulled out a chair and sat down. As Augustus was ladling himself a big scoop of beans, Carl stuck his plate under the ladle. Newt thought it was such a slick move that he laughed out loud.
"Many thanks," Carl said. "If you ever get tired of loafing, I guess you could get a job waiting tables." "Why, I had a job waiting tables once," Augustus said, pretending he had meant to serve Carl the beans. "On a riverboat. I wasn't no older than Newt when I had that job. Cook even wore a white hat."
"What for?" B.I. asked.
"Because it's what real cooks are supposed to wear," Augustus said, looking at Bolivar, who was stirring a little coffee in his brown sugar. "Not so much as a hat as a kind of big white cap. It looked like it could have been made out of a bedsheet."
"I'd be damned if I'd wear one," Carl said.
"Nobody'd be loony enough to hire you to cook, Woodrow," Augustus said. "The cap is supposed to keep the cook's old greasy hairs from falling into the food. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if some of Bowles' hairs have found their way into this sow bosom."
Newt looked at Bolivar, sitting over by the stove in his dirty serape. Bolivar's hair looked like it had had a can of second-hand lard poured over it. Once every few months, Bull would change clothes and go visit his wife, but his efforts at improving his appearance never went much higher than his mustache, which he occasionally tried to wax with grease of some kind.
"How come you quit the riverboat?" P.I. asked. "I was too young and pretty," Augustus said.
and the whores wouldn't let me alone. Call was sorry it had come up. He didn't like talk about whores, not any time, but particularly not in front of the boy. Augustus had little shame, if any. It had long been a sore spot between them. "Well, I wish they'd have drowned you then," Call said, annoyed. Conversation at the table seldom led to any good. Newt kept his eye on his plate, as he usually did when the captain grew annoyed. "Drown me? Why, if anybody had tried it, those girls would have clawed him to shreds." He knew Call was mad, but he wasn't much inclined to humor him. It was his dinner table as much as Call's, and if Call didn't like the conversation, he could go to bed. Call knew there was no point in arguing. That was what Augustus wanted, argument. He didn't really care what the question was, and it made no great difference to him which side he was on. He just plain loved to argue, whereas Call hated to. Long experience had taught him that there was no winning arguments with Augustus, even in cases where there was a simple right and wrong at issue. Even in the old days, when they were in the thick of it, with Indians and hard cases to worry about, Augustus would seize any chance for a dispute. Practically the closest Call they ever had, when the two of them and six rangers got surprised by the Comanches up the Prairie Dog Fork of the Red, they were all digging holes in the bank that could have turned out to be their graves if they hadn't been lucky and got a cloudy night and sneaked away. Augustus had kept up a running argument with a ranger they called Ugly Bobby. The argument was entirely about coon dogs, and Augustus had kept it up all night, though most of the rangers were so scared they couldn't pass water. Of course, the boy lapped up Augustus's stories about river boats and whores. The boy hadn't been anywhere, so it was all romance to him. "Listening to you brag about women don't improve the taste of my food," he said finally. "Call, if you want better food, you have to start by shooting Bolivar," Augustus said, reminded of his own grievance against the cook. "Bowl, I want you to quit whacking that bell with the crowbar," he said. "Now, you can do it at noon if you want to, but you let off doing it at night. Man with any sense can tell when it's sundown. You spoilt many a pretty evening for me whacking that bell." Bolivar stirred his sugary coffee and held his peace. He whacked the dinner bell because he liked the sound, not because he wanted anybody to come to eat. And the men could eat when they liked. He would whack the bell when he liked. He enjoyed being a cook. It was a good deal more relaxing than being a bandit. But that didn't mean that he intended to take orders. His sense of independence was undiminished. "General Lee freed the slaves," he remarked in a surly tone. Newt laughed. Bowl never had been able to get the war straight, but he had been genuinely sorry when it ended. In fact, if it had kept going, he would have probably have stayed a bandit. It was a safe and profitable profession with most of the Texans gone, but the ones who came back from the war were mostly bandits themselves, and they had better guns. The profession immediately became overcrowded. Bolivar knew it was time to quit, but once in a while he got the urge for a little shooting. "It wasn't General Lee. It was Abe Lincoln who freed the slaves," Augustus pointed out. Bolivar shrugged. "No difference," he said. "The big difference," Call said. "One was a Yankee and one wasn't." P.I. got interested for a minute. The beans and sow belly had revived him. He had been very interested in the notion of emancipation and had studied over it a lot while he went about his work. It was obviously just pure luck that he himself hadn't been born a slave, but if he had been unlucky, Lincoln would have freed him. It gave him a certain admiration for the man. "He just freed Americans," he pointed out to Bolivar. Augustus snorted. "You're in over your head, P. Who Abe Lincoln freed was a bunch of Africans, no more American than Call here." Call pushed back his chair. He was not about to sit around arguing slavery after a long day, or after a short one either. "I'm as American as the next," he said, taking his hat and picking up his rifle. "Now, you was born in Scotland," Augustus reminded him. "I know they brought you over when you was still dragging on the tit, but that don't make you no less a Scot." Call didn't reply. Newt looked up and saw him standing at the door, his hat on and his Henry in the crook of his arm. A couple of big moths flew past his head, drawn to the light of the kerosene lamp on the table. With nothing more said, the captain went out the door.
Chapter 2.
Carl walked the river for an hour, though he knew there was no real need. It was just an old habit he had had, left over from the wilder times, checking, looking for a sign of one kind or another, honing his instincts as much as anything. In his years as a ranger captain, it had been his habit to get off by himself for a time every night, out of camp and away from whatever talking and bickering were going on. He had discovered early on that his instincts needed privacy in which to operate. Sitting around a fire being sociable, yawning and yarning, might be fine in a safe country, but it would cost you an edge in a country that wasn't so safe. He liked to get off by himself, a mile or so from camp, and listen to the country, not the men. Of course, real scouting skills were superfluous in a place as tame as Lonesome Dove, but Carl still liked to get out at night, sniff the breeze, and let the country talk. The country talked quiet. One human voice could drown it out, particularly if it was a voice as loud as Augustus McCrae's. Augustus was notorious all over Texas for the strength of his voice. On a still night, he could be heard at least a mile, even if he was more or less whispering. Carl did his best to get out of range of Augustus's voice so that he could relax and pay attention to other sounds. If nothing else, he might get a clue as to what weather was coming. Not that there was much mystery about the weather around Lonesome Dove. If a man looked straight up at the stars, he was apt to get dizzy. The night was so clear, clouds were scarcer than cash money, and cash money was scarce enough. There was really little in the way of a threat to be looked for, either. A coyote might sneak in and snatch a chicken, but that was about the worst that was likely to happen. The mere fact that he and Augustus were there had long since discouraged the local horse thieves. Carl angled west of town toward a crossing on the river that had once been favored by the Comanches in the days when they had the leisure to raid into Mexico. It was near a salt lick. He had formed a habit of walking up to the crossing almost every night, sit for a while on a little bluff, just watching. If the moon was high enough to cast a shadow, he sheltered beside a clump of chaparral. If the Comanches ever came again, it stood to reason that they would make for their old crossing. But Carl knew well enough the Comanches weren't going to come again. They were all but whipped, hardly enough warriors left free to terrorize the upper Brazos, much less the Rio Grande. The business with the Comanches had been long and ugly. It had occupied Carl most of his adult life, but it was really over. In fact, it had been so long since he had seen a really dangerous Indian that if one had suddenly ridden up to the crossing, he would probably have been too surprised to shoot. Exactly the kind of careless attitude he was concerned to guard against in himself. Whipped they might be, but as long as there was one free Comanche with a horse and a gun, it would be foolish to take them lightly. He tried hard to keep sharp, but in fact the only action he had scared up in 6 months of watching the river was one bandit, who might just have been a vaquero with a thirsty horse. All Carl had had to do in that instance was click the hammer of his Henry. In the still of the night, the click had been as effective as a shot. The man wheeled back into Mexico, and since then nothing had disturbed the crossing except a few mangy goats on their way to the salt lick. Even though he still came to the river every night, it was obvious to Carl that Lonesome Dove had long since ceased to need guarding. The talk about Bolivar calling up bandits was just another of Augustus's overworked jokes. He came to the river because he liked to be alone for an hour, and not always be crowded. It seemed to him that he was pressed from dawn until dark, but for no good reason. And as a ranger captain, he was naturally pressed to make decisions, and decisions that might mean life or death to the men under him. That had been a natural pressure, one that went with the job. Men looked to him and kept looking, wanting to know he was still there, able to bring them through whatever scrape they might be in. Augustus was just as capable. Beneath all his rant, He would have got them through the same scrapes if it had been necessary, but Augustus wouldn't bother rising to an occasion until it became absolutely necessary. He left the worrying to Call, so the men looked to Call for orders and got drunk with Augustus. It never ceased to gripe him that Augustus could not be made to act like a ranger except in emergencies. His refusal was so consistent that at times both Call and the men would almost hope for an emergency so that Gus would let up talking and arguing and treat the situation with a little respect. But somehow, despite the dangers, Call had never felt pressed in quite the way he had lately, bound in by the small but constant needs of others. The physical work didn't matter. Call was not one to sit on the porch all day playing cards or gossiping. He intended to work. He had just grown tired of always providing the example. He was still a captain, but no one had seemed to notice that there was no troop and no war. He had been in charge so long that everyone assumed all thoughts, questions, needs, wants had to be referred to him, however simple these might be. The men couldn't stop expecting him to captain, and he couldn't stop thinking he had to. It was ingrained in him. He had done it so long, but he was aware that it wasn't appropriate anymore. They weren't even peace officers. They just ran a livery stable, trading horses and cattle when they could find a buyer. The work they did was mostly work he could do in his sleep, and yet, though his day-to-day responsibilities had constantly shrunk over the last 10 years, life did not seem easier. It just seemed smaller and a good deal more dull. Call was not a man to daydream. That was Gus's department. But then it wasn't really daydreaming he did, alone on the little bluff at night. It was just thinking back to years when a man who presumed to stake out a Comanche trail would do well to keep his rifle cocked. Yet the fact that he had taken to thinking back annoyed him, too. He didn't want to start working over his memories like an old man. Sometimes he would force himself to get up and walk 2 or 3 more miles up the river and back, just to get the memories out of his head. Not until he felt alert again. Felt that he could still captain if the need arose, would he return to Lonesome Dove. After supper, when Call left for the river, Augustus, P.I., Newt, Bolivar, and the pigs repaired to the porch. The pigs nosed around in the yard, occasionally catching a lizard or a grasshopper, a rat snake, or an unwary locust. Bolivar brought out a whetstone and spent 20 minutes or so sharpening the fine bone-handled knife that he wore at his belt. The handle was made from the horn of a mule deer, and the thin blade flashed in the moonlight as Bolivar carefully drew it back and forth across a whetstone, spitting on the stone now and then to dampen its surface. Although Newt liked Bolivar and considered him a friend, the fact that Bol felt it necessary to sharpen the knife every night made him a little nervous. Mr. Gus's constant joking about bandits, although Newt knew it was joking, had its effect. It was a mystery to him why Bol sharpened the knife every single night, since he never cut anything with it. When he asked him about it, Bol smiled and tested the blade gently with his thumb. "It's like a wife," he said. "Every night you better stroke it." It made no sense to Newt, but got a laugh from Augustus.
"If that's the case, your wife is pretty rusty by now, Bol. She don't get sharpened more than twice a year."
"She is old," Bolivar said.
"The older the violin, the sweeter the music. Us old folks appreciate wetting just as much as the young, and maybe more. You ought to bring her up here to live, Bol. Well, think of the money you'd save on whetstones."
"That knife would cut through a man's neck like it was butter," P.I. said. He had an appreciation for such things, being the owner of a fine Bowie knife himself. It had a 14-inch blade, and he had bought it from a soldier who had personally commissioned it from Bowie. He didn't sharpen it every night like Bol did his, but he took it out of his big sheath once in a while to make sure it hadn't lost its edge. It was his Sunday knife, and he didn't use it for ordinary work like butchering or cutting leather. Bolivar never used his for ordinary work either, though once in a while, if he was in a good mood, he would throw it and stick it in the side of the wagon. or maybe shave off a few fine curls of rawhide with it. Newt would then feed the rawhide to the pigs. Augustus himself took a dim view of the utility of knives, particularly of fancy knives. He carried a plain old clasp in his pocket and used it mainly for cutting his toenails. In the old days, when they all lived mostly off game, he carried a good skinning knife as a matter of necessity, but he had no regard at all for a knife as a fighting weapon. So far as he was concerned, the invention of the Colt revolver had rendered all other short-range weapons obsolete. It was a minor irritant that he had to spend virtually every night of his life listening to Bull grind his blade away. "If I have to listen to something, I'd rather listen to you wet your wife." "I don't bring her," Bull said. "I know you. You would try to corrupt her." Augustus laughed. "No, I ain't much given to corrupting old women," he said. "Ain't you got any daughters?" "Only 9, Bolivar said. Abruptly, not even getting up, he threw the knife at the nearest wagon where it stuck, quivering for a moment. The wagon was only about 20 feet away, so it was no great throw, but he wanted to make a point about his feeling for his daughters. 6 were married already, but the 3 left at home were the light of his life. "Yeah, I hope they take after their mother," Augustus said. "If they take after you, you're in for a passel of old maids." His Colt was hanging off the back of the chair, and he reached around and got it, took it out of its holster, and idly twirled the chamber a time or two, listening to the pretty little clicks. Bolivar was sorry he had thrown the knife, since it meant that he would have to get up and walk across the yard to retrieve it. At the moment, his hip joints hurt, as well as several other joints, all the result of letting a horse fall on him 5 years before. "I am better looking than a buzzard like you," he said, pulling himself up. Newt knew Bolivar and Mr. Gus were just insulting one another to pass the time, but it still made him nervous when they did it, particularly late in the day, when they had both been hitting their respective jugs for several hours. It was a peaceful night, so still that he could occasionally hear the sound of the piano down at the Dry Bean Saloon. The piano was the pride of the saloon, and for that matter, of the town. Church folks even borrowed it on Sundays. Luckily, the church house was right next to the saloon, and the piano had wheels. Some of the deacons had built a ramp out of the back of the saloon and a board track across to the church so that all they had to do was to push the piano right across to the church. Even so, the arrangement was a great threat to the sobriety of the deacons, some of whom considered it their duty to spend their evenings in the saloon, safeguarding the piano. Once they safeguarded it so well on Saturday night that they ran it off its rail on Sunday morning and broke 2 legs off of it. Since there weren't enough sober men in the church that morning to carry it inside, Mrs. Pink Higgins, who played it, had to sit out in the street and bang away at the hymns, while the rest of the congregation, 10 ladies and a preacher, stayed inside and sang. The arrangement was made more awkward still by the fact that Lorena Wood came out on the back stairs of the saloon, practically undressed, and listened to the hymns. Newt was deeply in love with Lorena Wood, though so far he had not even had an opportunity to speak to her. He was painfully aware that if the chance for personal speech ever did arise, he would have no idea what to say. On the rare occasions when he had an errand that took him by the saloon, he lived in terror, afraid some accident might occur which would actually force him to speak to her. He wanted to speak to Lorena, of course. It represented the very summit of his life's hopes, but he didn't want to have to do it until he had decided on the best thing to say, which so far he had not. Though Lorena had been in town for several months, and he had been in love with her from the moment he first glimpsed her face. On an average day, Lorena occupied Newt's thoughts about 8 hours, no matter what task occupied his hands. Though normally an open young man, quick to talk about his problems, to P.I. and Dietz at least, he had never so much as uttered Lorena's name aloud. He knew that if he did utter it, a terrible amount of ribbing would ensue, and while he didn't mind being ribbed about most things, his feelings for Lorena were too serious to admit frivolity. The men who made up the Hat Creek outfit were not great respecters of feeling, particularly tender feeling. There was also the danger that someone might slight her honor. It wouldn't be the captain, who was not prone to jesting about women, or even mentioning them, but the thought of the complications that might arise from an insult to Lorena had left Newt closely acquainted with the mental perils of love long before he had had an opportunity to sample any of its pleasures, except the infinite pleasures of contemplation. Of course, Newt knew that Lorena was a whore. It was an awkward fact, but it didn't lessen his feelings for her one whit. She had been abandoned in Lonesome Dove by a gambler who decided she was bad for his luck. She lived over the dry bean and was known to receive visitors of various descriptions, but Newt was not a young man to choke on such details. He was not absolutely sure what whores did, but he assumed that Lorena had come by her profession as accidentally as he had come by his. It was pure accident that he happened to be a horse wrangler for the Hat Creek outfit, and no doubt an equally pure one that had made Lorena a whore. What Newt loved about her was her nature, which he could see in her face. It was easily the most beautiful face that had ever been seen in Lonesome Dove, and he had no doubt that hers was the most beautiful nature, too. He intended to say something along those lines to her when he finally spoke to her. Much of his time on the porch after supper was spent in trying to figure out what words would best express such sentiment. That was why it irritated him slightly when Bowl and Mr. Gus started passing insults back and forth as if they were biscuits. They did it almost every night, and pretty soon they'd be throwing knives and clicking pistols, making it very hard for him to concentrate on what he would say to Lorena when they first met. Neither Mr. Gus nor Bolivar had lived their lives as peaceful men, and it seemed to him that they might both be itching for one last fight. Newt had no doubt that if such a fight occurred, Mr. Gus would win. P.I. claimed that he was a better pistol shot than Captain Call, though it was hard for Newt to imagine anyone being better at anything than Captain Call. He didn't want the fight to happen, because it would mean the end of Bowl, and despite a slight nervousness about Bowl's bandit friends, he did like Bowl. The old man had given him serape once to use as a blanket, and had let him have the bottom bunk when he was sick with jaundice. If Mr. Gus shot him, it would mean Newt had one less friend. Since he had no family, this was not a thought to be taken lightly. "What do you reckon the captain does out there in the dark?" he asked. Augusta smiled at the boy, who was hunched over on the lower step, as nervous as a red pup. He asked the same question almost every night when he thought there might be a fight. He wanted Call around to stop it, if it ever started. "Ah, he's just playing Indian fighter," he said. Newt doubted that. The captain was not one to play. If he felt he had to go off and sit in the dark every night, he must think it important. Mention of Indians woke P.I. from an alcoholic doze. He hated Indians, partly because for 30 years fear of them had kept him from getting a good night's sleep. In his years with the Rangers, he never closed his eyes without expecting to open them and find some huge Indian getting ready to poke him with something sharp. Most of the Indians he had actually seen had all been scrawny little men, but it didn't mean the huge one who haunted his sleep wasn't out there waiting. "Why, they could come," he said. "The captain's right to watch. If I wasn't so lazy, I'd go help him." "He don't want you to help him," Augusta said testily. P's blind loyalty to Call was sometimes a trial. He himself knew perfectly well why Call headed for the river every night, and it had very little to do with the Indian threat. He had made the point many times, but he made it again. "He heads for the river because he's tired of hearing us yap. He ain't a sociable man and never was. You could never keep him in camp once he had his grub. He'd rather sit off in the dark and prime his gun. I doubt if he'd find an Indian if one was out there." "He used to find them," P said. "He found that big gang of them up by Fort Phantom Hill." "Ah, God, P. Of course he found a few here and there. They used to be thicker than grass burrs, if you remember. Now, I'll guarantee he won't scratch up none tonight. Call's got to be the one to outsuffer everybody. That's the point. I won't say he's a man to hunt glory like some I've knowed. Glory doesn't interest Call.
He just got to do his duty 9 times over, or he don't sleep good. There was a pause. P.I. had always been uncomfortable with Gus's criticism of the captain, without having any idea how to answer them. If he came back at all, he usually just adopted one of the captain's own remarks. "Well, somebody's got to take the hard seat," he said. "Fine with me," Augustus said. "Call can suffer for you and me and Newt and Dietz and everybody else who don't want to do it for themselves. It's been right handy having him around to assume them burdens all these years. But if you think that he's doing it for us and not because it's what he happens to like doing, then you're a damn fool. He's out there sitting behind a chaparral bush congratulating himself on not having to listen to Bull brag on his wife. He knows as well as I do there isn't a hostile within 600 miles of here." Bolivar stood over by the wagon and relieved himself for what seemed to Newt like 10 or 15 minutes. Often when Bull started to relieve himself, Mr. Gus would yank out his old silver pocket watch and squint at it until the pissing stopped. Sometimes he even got a stub of a pencil and a little notebook out of his old black vest he always wore and wrote down how long it took Bolivar to pass his water. "It's a clue to how fast he's failing," Augustus pointed out. "An old man finally dribbles, same as a fresh calf. I best just keep a record so we'll know when to start looking for a new cook." For once, though, the pigs took more interest in Bowl's performance than Mr. Gus, who just drank a little more whiskey. Bowl yanked his knife out of the side of the wagon and disappeared into the house. Pigs came to Newt to get their ears scratched. P.I. slumped against the porch railing and began to snore. "P., wake up and go to bed," Augustus said, kicking at his leg until he waked him. "Newt and I might forget and leave you out here. If we done that, these critters would eat you, belt buckle and all." P.I. got up without really opening his eyes and stumbled into the house. "They wouldn't really eat him," Newt said. Blue Shote was on the lower step, friendly as a dog. "No, but it takes a good threat to get P moving." Newt saw the captain coming back, his rifle in the crook of his arm. As always, Newt felt relieved. It eased something inside of him to know that the captain was back. It made it easier to sleep. Lodged in his mind somewhere was the worry that maybe some night the captain wouldn't come back. It wasn't a worry that he would meet with some accident or be killed, either. It was a worry that he might just leave. It seemed to Newt that the captain was probably tired of them all, and with some justice. He and P and Dietz did their best to pull their weight, but Mr. Gus never pulled any weight at all. And Bowl sat around and drank tequila most of the day. Maybe the captain would just saddle up to Hellbitch some night and go. Once in a great while, Newt dreamed that the captain not only left, but took him with him. The high plains that he had heard about but never seen. There was never anyone else in the dreams, just him and the captain, horseback in a beautiful grassy country. Those were sweet dreams, but just dreams. If the captain did leave, he would probably take P along, since P had been his corporal for so many years. "I don't see any scalps," Augustus said when Call came up. Call ignored him, leaned his rifle against the porch rail, and lit a smoke. "This would have been a good night to cross some stock," he said. "Cross 'em and do what with 'em? I ain't seen no cattle buyers yet." "We could actually take the cattle to them," Call said. "It's been done. It ain't against the law for you to work." "It ain't against my law," Augustus said. "Them buyers ain't nailed down. They'll show up directly. Then we'll cross the stock." "Captain, can I go next time?" Newt asked. "I believe I'm getting old enough." Call hesitated. Pretty soon he was going to have to say yes, but he wasn't ready just then. It wasn't really fair to the boy. He would have to learn sometime, but still Call couldn't quite say it. He had led boys as young in his day and seen them killed, which was why he kept putting Newt off. "You'll get old quick if you keep setting up all night," he said. "Work to do tomorrow. You best go to bed." The boy went at once, looking a little disappointed. "Night, son,"
Augustus said, looking at Call when he said it. Call said nothing. You should have let him sit, Augustus said a little later. After all, a boy's only chance for an education is listening to me talk. Call let that one float off. Augustus had spent a year in a college back in Virginia somewhere and claimed to have learned his Greek letters, plus a certain amount of Latin. He never let anyone forget it. Now, they could hear the piano from down at the dry bean, and an old-timer named Lippy Jones did all the playing. He had the same problem Sam Houston